conforming his life to the evolutionary order, a man can command no concessionary haste from nature but, living without error against the laws of his physical and mental endowment, still requires about a million years of incarnating masquerades to know final emancipation. The telescopic methods of yogis, disengaging themselves from physical and mental identifications in favor of soul individuality, thus commend themselves to those who eye with revolt a thousand years. This numerical periphery is enlarged for the ordinary man, who lives in harmony not even with nature, let alone his soul, but pursues instead unnatural complexities, thus offending in his body and thoughts the sweet sanities of nature. For him, 2 × 1,000,000 years can scarce suffice for liberation. Gross man seldom or never realizes that his body is a kingdom, governed by Emperor Sol on the throne of the cranium, with subsidiary regents in the 6 spinal centers or spheres of consciousness. This theocracy extends over a throng of obedient subjects, 27,000 billion souls endowed with a sure if automatic intelligence by which they perform all duties of bodily growths, transformations, and dissolutions, and 50 million substratal thoughts, emotions, and variations of alternating phases in man's consciousness in an average life of 60 years. Any apparent insurrection of bodily or cerebral cells toward Emperor Sol, manifesting as disease or depression, is due to no disloyalty among the humble citizens, but to past or present misuse by man of his individuality or free will, given to him simultaneous with a soul, irrevocable never. Identifying himself with a shallow ego, man takes for granted that it is he who thinks, wills, feels, digests meals, and keeps himself alive, never admitting through reflection, only a little would suffice, that in his ordinary life he is naught but a puppet of past actions, karma, and of nature or environment. Each man's intellectual reactions, feelings, moods, and habits are circumscribed by effects of past causes, whether of this or a prior life. Lofty above such influences, however, is his regal soul. Spurning the transitory truths and freedoms, the Kriya Yogi passes beyond all disillusionment into his unfettered being. All scriptures declare man to be not a corruptible body, but a living soul. By Kriya he is given a method to prove the scriptural truth. Outward ritual cannot destroy ignorance, because they are not mutually contradictory, wrote Shankara in his famous Century of Verses. Realized knowledge alone destroys ignorance. Knowledge cannot spring up by any other means than inquiry. Who am I? How was this universe, the science of Kriya Yoga, born? Who is its maker? What is its material cause? This is the kind of inquiry referred to. The intellect has no answer for these questions, hence the rishis evolved yoga as the technique of spiritual inquiry. Kriya Yoga is the real fire rite often extolled in the Bhagavad Gita. The purifying fires of yoga bring eternal illumination, and thus differ much from outward and little effective religious fire ceremonies, where perception of truth is oft burnt, to solemn chanted accompaniment, along with the incense. The advanced yogi, withholding all his mind, will, and feeling from false identification with bodily desires, uniting his mind with superconscious forces in the spinal shrines, thus lives in this world as God hath planned, not impelled by impulses from the past nor by new witlessnesses of fresh human motivations. Such a yogi receives fulfillment of his supreme desire, safe in the final haven of inexhaustibly blissful spirit. The yogi offers his labyrinthine human longings to a monotheistic bonfire dedicated to the unparalleled God. This is indeed the true yogic fire ceremony, in which all past and present desires are fuel consumed by love divine. The ultimate flame receives the sacrifice of all human madness, and man is pure of dross. His bones stripped of all desirous flesh, his karmic skeleton bleached in the antiseptic suns of wisdom, he is clean at last, inoffensive before man and maker. Referring to yoga's sure and methodical efficacy, Lord Krishna praises the technological yogi in the following words: "The yogi is greater than body-disciplining ascetics, greater even than the followers of the path of wisdom, Jnana Yoga, or of the path of action, Karma Yoga, be thou, O disciple Arjuna, a yogi. Chapter 27. Founding a yoga school in Ranchi. Why are you averse to organizational work? Master's question startled me a bit. It is true that my private conviction at the time was that organizations were hornets' nests. It is a thankless task, sir, I answered. No matter what the leader does or does not, he is criticized. Do you want the whole divine chana, milk curd, for yourself alone? My guru's retort was accompanied by a stern glance. Could you or anyone else achieve God contact through yoga if a line of generous-hearted masters had not been willing to convey their knowledge to others? He added, God is the honey, organizations are the hives, both are necessary. Any form is useless, of course, without the spirit. But why should you not start busy hives full of the spiritual nectar? His counsel moved me deeply. Although I made no outward reply, an adamant resolution rose in my breast. I would share with my fellows, so far as lay in my power, the unshackling truths I had learned at my guru's feet. Lord, I prayed, may thy love shine forever on the sanctuary of my devotion, and may I be able to awaken that love in other hearts. On a previous occasion, before I had joined the monastic order, Sri Yukteswar had made a most unexpected remark. How you will miss the companionship of a wife in your old age, he had said. Do you not agree that the family man, engaged in useful work to maintain his wife and children, thus plays a rewarding role in God's eyes? Sir, I had protested in alarm, you know that my desire in this life is to espouse only the cosmic beloved. Master had laughed so merrily that I understood his observation was made merely as a test of my faith. Remember, he had said slowly, that he who discards his worldly duties can justify himself only by assuming some kind of responsibility toward a much larger family. The ideal of an all-sided education for youth had always been close to my heart. I saw clearly the arid results of ordinary instruction, aimed only at the development of body and intellect, moral and spiritual values, without whose appreciation no man can approach happiness, were yet lacking in the formal curriculum. I determined to found a school where young boys could develop to the full stature of manhood. My first step in that direction was made with 7 children at Dihika, a small country site in Bengal. A year later, in 1918, through the generosity of Sir Manindra Chandranandi, the Maharaja of Kasimbaza, I was able to transfer my fast-growing group to Ranchi. This town in Bihar, about 200 miles from Calcutta, is blessed with one of the most healthful climates in India. The Kasimbaza Palace at Ranchi was transformed into the headquarters for the new school, which I called Brahmacharya Vidyalaya in accordance with the educational ideals of the Rishis. Their forest ashrams had been the ancient seats of learning, secular and divine, for the youth of India. At Ranchi I organized an educational program for both grammar and high school grades. It included agricultural, industrial, commercial, and academic subjects. The students were also taught yoga concentration and meditation, and a unique system of physical development, Yogoda, whose principles I had discovered in 1916. Realizing that man's body is like an electric battery, I reasoned that it could be recharged with energy through the direct agency of the human will. As no action, slight or large, is possible without willing, man can avail himself of his prime mover, will, to renew his bodily tissues without burdensome apparatus or mechanical exercises. I therefore taught the Ranchi students my simple Yogoda techniques by which the life force, centered in man's medulla oblongata, can be consciously and instantly recharged from the unlimited supply of cosmic energy. The boys responded wonderfully to this training, developing extraordinary ability to shift the life energy from one part of the body to another part, and to sit in perfect poise in difficult body postures. They performed feats of strength and endurance which many powerful adults could not equal. My youngest brother, Bhishanchiran Ghosh, joined the Ranchi school. He later became a leading physical culturist in Bengal. He and one of his students traveled to Europe and America, giving exhibitions of strength and skill which amazed the university savants, including those at Columbia University in New York. At the end of the first year at Ranchi, applications for admission reached 2,000. But the school, which at that time was solely residential, could accommodate only about 100. Instruction for day students was soon added. In the Vidyalaya, I had to play father-mother to the little children, and to cope with many organizational difficulties. I often remembered Christ's words, "Verily I say unto you, there is no man that hath left house, or brethren or sisters, or father, or mother, or wife, or children, or lands, for my sake, and the gospel's, but he shall receive an hundredfold now in this time, houses and brethren, and sisters, and mothers, and children, and lands, with persecutions, and in the world to come eternal life." A Sri Yukteswar had interpreted these words: "The devotee who foregoes the life experiences of marriage and family, and exchanges the problems of a small household and limited activities for the larger responsibilities of service to society in general, is undertaking a task which is often accompanied by persecution from a misunderstanding world, but also by a divine inner contentment." One day my father arrived in Ranchi to bestow a paternal blessing, long withheld because I had hurt him by refusing his offer of a position with the Bengal Nagpur Railway. "Son," he said, "I am now reconciled to your choice in life. It gives me joy to see you amidst these happy, eager youngsters. You belong here rather than with the lifeless figures of railroad timetables." He waved toward a group of a dozen little ones who were tagging at my heels. "I had only 8 children," he observed with twinkling eyes, "but I can feel for you. With a large fruit orchard and 25 fertile acres at our disposal, the students, teachers, and myself enjoyed many happy hours of outdoor labor in these ideal surroundings. We had many pets, including a young deer who was fairly idolized by the children. I too loved the fawn so much that I allowed it to sleep in my room. At the light of dawn, the little creature would toddle over to my bed for a morning caress. One day I fed the pet earlier than usual, as I had to attend to some business in the town of Ranchi. Although I cautioned the boys not to feed the fawn until my return, one of them was disobedient, and gave the baby deer a large quantity of milk. When I came back in the evening, sad news greeted me: the little fawn is nearly dead, through overfeeding." In tears, I placed the apparently lifeless pet on my lap. I prayed piteously to God to spare its life. Hours later, the small creature opened its eyes, stood up, and walked feebly. The whole school shouted for joy. But a deep lesson came to me that night, one I can never forget. I stayed up with the fawn until 2 o'clock, when I fell asleep. The deer appeared in a dream, and spoke to me, "You are holding me back. Please let me go, let me go." "All right," I answered in the dream. A yoga school at Ranchi, I awoke immediately, and cried out, "Boys, the deer is dying." The children rushed to my side. I ran to the corner of the room where I had placed the pet. It made a last effort to rise, stumbled toward me, then dropped at my feet, dead. According to the mass karma which guides and regulates the destinies of animals, the deer's life was over, and it was ready to progress to a higher form. But by my deep attachment, which I later realized was selfish, and by my fervent prayers, I had been able to hold it in the limitations of the animal form from which the soul was struggling for release. The soul of the deer made its plea in a dream because, without my loving permission, it either would not or could not go. As soon as I agreed, it departed. All sorrow left me. I realized anew that God wants his children to love everything as a part of him, and not to feel delusively that death ends all. The ignorant man sees only the unsurmountable wall of death, hiding, seemingly forever, his cherished friends. But the man of unattachment, he who loves others as expressions of the Lord, understands that at death the dear ones have only returned for a breathing space of joy in him. The Ranchi school grew from small and simple beginnings to an institution now well known in India. Many departments of the school are supported by voluntary contributions from those who rejoice in perpetuating the educational ideals of the rishis. Under the general name of Yogoda Satsanga, flourishing branch schools have been established at Midnapore, Lakshmanpur, and Puri. The Ranchi headquarters maintains a medical department where medicines and the services of doctors are supplied freely to the poor of the locality. The number treated has averaged more than 18,000 persons a year. The Vidyalaya has made its mark, too, in Indian competitive sports, and in the scholastic field, where many Ranchi alumni have distinguished themselves in later university life. The school, now in its 28th year and the center of many activities, has been honored by visits of eminent men from the East and the West. One of the earliest great figures to inspect the Vidyalaya in its first year was Swami Pranabananda, the Benares saint with two bodies. As the great master viewed the picturesque outdoor classes, held under the trees, and saw in the evening that young boys were sitting motionless for hours in yoga meditation, he was profoundly moved. "Joy comes to my heart," he said, "to see that Lahiri Mahasaya's ideals for the proper training of youth are being carried on in this institution. My guru's blessings be on it." A young lad sitting by my side ventured to ask the great yogi a question. "Sir," he said, "shall I be a monk? Is my life only for God?" Though Swami Pranabananda smiled gently, his eyes were piercing the future. "Child," he replied, "when you grow up, there is a beautiful bride waiting for you." The boy did eventually marry, after having planned for years to enter the Swami order. Sometime after Swami Pranabananda had visited Ranchi, I accompanied my father to the Calcutta house where the yogi was temporarily staying. Pranabananda's prediction, made to me so many years before, came rushing to my mind. "I shall see you, with your father, later on." As father entered the Swami's room, the great yogi rose from his seat and embraced my parent with loving respect. "Bhagavati," he said, "what are you doing about yourself? Don't you see your son racing to the infinite?" I blushed to hear his praise before my father. The Swami went on, "You recall how often our blessed guru used to say, Banat, Banat, Banjai. I so keep up Kriya Yoga ceaselessly, and reach the divine portals quickly." The body of Pranabananda, which had appeared so well and strong during my amazing first visit to him in Benares, now showed definite aging, though his posture was still admirably erect. "Swamiji," I inquired, looking straight into his eyes, "please tell me the truth, aren't you feeling the advance of age? As the body is weakening, are your perceptions of God suffering any diminution?" He smiled angelically. "The beloved is more than ever with me now." His complete conviction overwhelmed my mind and soul. He went on, "I am still enjoying the two pensions, one from Bhagavati here, and one from above." Pointing his finger heavenward, the saint fell into an ecstasy, his face lit with a divine glow, an ample answer to my question. Noticing that Pranabananda's room contained many plants and packages of seed, I asked their purpose. "I have left Benares permanently," he said, "and am now on my way to the Himalayas. There I shall open an ashram for my disciples. These seeds will produce spinach and a few other vegetables. My dear ones will live simply, spending their time in blissful God union. Nothing else is necessary." Father asks his brother disciple when he would return to Calcutta. "Never again," the saint replied. "This year is the one in which Lahiri Mahasaya told me I would leave my beloved Benares forever and go to the Himalayas, that to throw off my mortal frame." My eyes filled with tears at his words, but the Swami smiled tranquilly. He reminded me of a little heavenly child, sitting securely on the lap of the Divine Mother. The burden of the years has no ill effect on a great yogi's full possession of supreme spiritual powers. He is able to renew his body at will, yet sometimes he does not care to retard the aging process, but allows his karma to work itself out on the physical plane, using his old body as a time-saving device to exclude the necessity of working out karma in a new incarnation. Months later I met an old friend, Sanandan, who was one of Prainabhananda's close disciples. "My adorable guru is gone," he told me, amidst sobs. "He established a hermitage near Rishikesh, and gave us loving training. When we were pretty well settled, and making rapid spiritual progress in his company, he proposed one day to feed a huge crowd from Rishikesh. I inquired why he wanted such a large number. 'This is my last festival ceremony,' he said." I did not understand the full implications of his words. Prainabhanandaji helped with the cooking of great amounts of food. We fed about 2,000 guests. After the feast, he sat on a high platform and gave an inspired sermon on the infinite. At the end, before the gaze of thousands, he turned to me, as I sat beside him on the dais, and spoke with unusual force. "Sanandan, be prepared, I am going to kick the frame." After a stunned silence, I cried loudly, "Master, don't do it. Please, please, don't do it." The crowd was tongue-tied, watching us curiously. My guru smiled at me, but his solemn gaze was already fixed on eternity. "Be not selfish," he said, "nor grieve for me. I have been long cheerfully serving you all, now rejoice and wish me Godspeed. I go to meet my cosmic beloved." In a whisper, Prainabhanandaji added, "I shall be reborn shortly. After enjoying a short period of the infinite bliss, I shall return to earth and join Babaji. You shall soon know when and where my soul has been encased in a new body." He cried again, "Sanandan, here I kick the frame by the second Kriya Yoga." He looked at the sea of faces before us, and gave a blessing. Directing his gaze inwardly to the spiritual eye, he became immobile. While the bewildered crowd thought he was meditating in an ecstatic state, he had already left the tabernacle of flesh and plunged his soul into the cosmic vastness. The disciples touched his body, seated in the lotus posture, but it was no longer the warm flesh. Only a stiffened frame remained. The tenant had fled to the immortal shore. I inquired where Prainabhananda was to be reborn. "That's a sacred trust I cannot divulge to anyone," Sanandan replied. "Perhaps you may find out some other way." Years later I discovered from Swami Keshabhananda that Prainabhananda, a few years after his birth in a new body, had gone to Badrinirayan in the Himalayas, and had joined the group of saints around the great Babaji. Chapter 28. Kashi, Reborn and Rediscovered. "Please do not go into the water. Let us bathe by dipping our buckets." I was addressing the young Ranchai students who were accompanying me on an 8-mile hike to a neighboring hill. The pond before us was inviting, but a distaste for it had arisen in my mind. The group around me followed my example of dipping buckets, but a few lads yielded to the temptation of the cool waters. No sooner had they dived than large water snakes wiggled around them. The boys came out of the pond with comical alacrity. We enjoyed a picnic lunch after we reached our destination. I sat under a tree, surrounded by a group of students. Finding me in an inspirational mood, they plied me with questions. "Please tell me, sir," one youth inquired, "if I shall always stay with you in the path of renunciation." "Ah, no," I replied, "you will be forcibly taken away to your home, and later you will marry." Incredulous, he made a vehement protest. "Only if I am dead can I be carried home." But in a few months, his parents arrived to take him away, in spite of his tearful resistance. Some years later, he did marry. After answering many questions, I was addressed by a lad, named Kashi. He was about 12 years old, a brilliant student, and beloved by all. "Sir," he said, "what will be my fate?" "You shall soon be dead," the reply came from my lips. 262. Kashi, Reborn and Rediscovered, with an irresistible force. This unexpected disclosure shocked and grieved me as well as everyone present. Silently rebuking myself as an enfant terrible, I refused to answer further questions. On our return to the school, Kashi came to my room. "If I die, will you find me when I am reborn, and bring me again to the spiritual path?" he sobbed. I felt constrained to refuse this difficult occult responsibility. But for weeks afterward, Kashi pressed me doggedly. Seeing him unnerved to the breaking point, I finally consoled him. "Yes," I promised. "If the Heavenly Father lends his aid, I will try to find you." During the summer vacation, I started on a short trip. Regretting that I could not take Kashi with me, I called him to my room before leaving, and carefully instructed him to remain, against all persuasion, in the spiritual vibrations of the school. Somehow I felt that if he did not go home, he might avoid the impending calamity. No sooner had I left than Kashi's father arrived in Ranchai. For 15 days he tried to break the will of his son, explaining that if Kashi would go to Calcutta for only 4 days to see his mother, he could then return. Kashi persistently refused. The father finally said he would take the boy away with the help of the police. The threat disturbed Kashi, who was unwilling to be the cause of any unfavorable publicity to the school. He saw no choice but to go. I returned to Ranchai a few days later. When I heard how Kashi had been removed, I entrained at once for Calcutta. There I engaged a horse cab. Very strangely, as the vehicle passed beyond the Howrah Bridge over the Ganges, I beheld Kashi's father and other relatives in mourning clothes. Shouting to my driver to stop, I rushed out and glared at the unfortunate father. "Mr. Murderer," I cried somewhat unreasonably, "you have killed my boy." The father had already realized the wrong he had done in forcibly bringing Kashi to Calcutta. During the few days the boy had been there, he had eaten contaminated food, left Kashi, lost and rediscovered. "Right, my brother Bhishanu, Motilal Mukherjee of Sarangpur, a highly advanced disciple of Sri Yukteswar, my father, Mr. Wright, myself, Tulsi Narayan Bose, Swami Satyananda of Ranchai, a group of delegates to the 1920 International Congress of Religious Liberals at Boston, where I gave my maiden speech in America. Left to right, Reverend Clay McCauley, Reverend T. Rhonda Williams, Professor S. U. Shigasaki, Reverend Jabez T. Sunderland, myself, Reverend Charles W. Wendt, Reverend Samuel A. Elliott, Reverend Basil Martin, Reverend Christopher J. Street, Reverend Samuel M. Crothers. Kashi, reborn and rediscovered, contracted cholera, and passed on. My love for Kashi, and the pledge to find him after death, night and day haunted me. No matter where I went, his face loomed up before me. I began a memorable search for him, even as long ago I had searched for my lost mother. I felt that inasmuch as God had given me the faculty of reason, I must utilize it and tax my powers to the utmost in order to discover the subtle laws by which I could know the boy's astral whereabouts. He was a soul vibrating with unfulfilled desires. I realized a mass of light floating somewhere amidst millions of luminous souls in the astral regions. How was I to tune in with him, among so many vibrating lights of other souls? Using a secret yoga technique, I broadcasted my love to Kashi's soul through the microphone of the spiritual eye, the inner point between the eyebrows. With the antenna of upraised hands and fingers, I often turned myself round and round, trying to locate the direction in which he had been reborn as an embryo. I hoped to receive response from him in the concentration-tuned radio of my heart. I intuitively felt that Kashi would soon return to the earth, and that if I kept unceasingly broadcasting my call to him, his soul would reply. I knew that the slightest impulse sent by Kashi would be felt in my fingers, hands, arms, spine, and nerves. With undiminished zeal, I practiced the yoga method steadily for about 6 months after Kashi's death. Walking with a few friends one morning in the crowded Bobaza section of Calcutta, I lifted my hands in the usual manner. For the first time, there was response. I thrilled to detect electrical impulses trickling down my fingers and palms. These currents translated themselves into one overpowering thought from a deep recess of my consciousness. "I am Kashi, I am Kashi, come to me." The thought became almost audible as I concentrated on my heart radio. In the characteristic, slightly hoarse whisper of Kashi, I heard his summons again and again. I seized the arm of one of my companions, Prakash Das, and smiled at him joyfully. It looks as though I have located Kashi. I began to turn round and round, to the undisguised amusement of my friends and the passing throng. The electrical impulses tingled through my fingers only when I faced toward a nearby path, aptly named Serpentine Lane. The astral currents disappeared when I turned in other directions. "Ah," I exclaimed, "Kashi's soul must be living in the womb of some mother whose home is in this lane.